This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself, who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes, and there are several features that really impressed me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think, teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week I have an extremely powerful conversation for you. Brian Sizemore is the founder of the Lucas Foundation and the father of law enforcement officer Lucas Sizemore. Jared Murphy is a special agent in Homeland Security and had worked with Lucas. The tragedy that brought these two men together was Lucas's suicide in 2024. So we discuss a host of topics, from Lucas's childhood through Brian's eyes, his journey into the world of law enforcement, Jared's path into Homeland Security, processing grief, the inception of the Lucas Foundation, the Bring Them Home 1,000-mile relay they'll be doing later this year, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So that being said, I introduce to you Brian Sizemore and Jared Murphy. Enjoy. Well, Brian and Jared, I want to start by saying thank you so, so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
It's our pleasure, James. It's our honor.
Thanks for having us on, James.
Beautiful. All right. Well, obviously, there's two of you today, two different locations, so I'll kind of bounce back and forth between the two of you. Let's start with you, Brian. Where on planet Earth are we finding you this morning?
I am in a small suburb south of Detroit called Woodhaven. Both Jared and I are both in the Detroit area. He's just on one side of town. I'm on the other.
Brilliant. So staying with you, let's start at the very beginning of your timeline. And obviously, we're going to walk through to your son and the reason that we're having this conversation today. But tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
I am in the same area that I was born and raised in. I've never moved, you know, out of town, out of state, anything like that. I'm probably 20 miles from where my childhood home is, where I grew up. I was a little town called River Rouge, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. Industrial town, back in the 50s and 60s is like a location where shipyards and steel mills and all of that type of stuff was located. Great little town, grew up there, got an education, got a good job. I work for AT&T. My wife is a school teacher. So we have a modest middle-class home, middle-class family here in Woodhaven. I'm the oldest of four children. I got two younger brothers and a younger sister. All of are still with us. My parents are still with us. My dad was he worked for Norfolk Southern Railway for, it got to be 40 years, I believe. My mom was a homemaker, and she had some small jobs as well.
Brilliant. Now, when I think of, you know, the Rust Belt and some of the other cities that were absolutely booming with industry, and then those jobs were sent away, mining is another example, that's more often than not is also a kind of hotbed when it comes to this mental health conversation that we're going to have. And the opioid crisis really kind of blew that open. With you having this lineage in the same place, what have you observed your generation, previous generations, of the impact of that on your local communities?
I think we've been blessed. My wife and I have been blessed to obtain and be able to keep a good job and make a good living and raise a family, but that's not easy. And I firmly believe it takes a lot of luck sometimes. But when you have friends or you see communities, especially industrial communities, that are hit hard and people have lost their jobs, it affects everything. It affects families. It affects the marriages. It affects, you know, their home. You know, people are losing their homes. And I think those things snowball to a point where I'm guessing, I don't know personally someone that it's happened to, but it probably starts with substance abuse. And then once you're on that path, if you don't get some help, it's just gonna snowball and get worse.
Absolutely. Well, Jared, let's jump over to you. Firstly, where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
Yeah, so I'm also in the Detroit area. I'm a little north of Brian. I live in a small town just northwest of Detroit called Franklin. Nice community.
Brilliant. And beginning of your origin story, where were you born? Tell me a little about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Colorado, born and raised in the Denver area. Lived there until I was 18 and went away to college. I've got one brother. He lives in New York with his family. His daughter actually is the fourth generation University of Colorado student. I think she might be the only one. She follows me and my mom and my grandmother and her mom. So that's a little bit in our family. My mom's a nurse, or was a nurse rather, retired now. My father was a small business owner. I'm a federal agent. I've been doing law enforcement as a career for the last 25 years. Moved around a little bit. I lived in Los Angeles and New York. We lived in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Had the opportunity to see the world. Did a year in school in your part of the world. I lived in Belfast for a year in the late 90s. That's a little snapshot of me.
Brilliant. Well, firstly, what took you into the world of law enforcement?
You know, when I was a young man in high school and college, this was kind of the time of Waco and Ruby Ridge when federal law enforcement was in the news a lot. And I thought that that was exciting. And I don't think that I was ever meant to be a desk job type person. I wanted something with adventure and excitement. And I think it just fit me. And when I was in college, I got an internship with the U.S. Customs Service Office of Investigations. Did a summer internship there, and I knew this is what I was going to do as a career. Fighting crime, fighting bad guys, you know, helping people, serving the country, all those things really spoke to me.
What was your experience firsthand in Belfast? Because when I think about the 90s, in my memory, being an Englishman, it was still quite a turbulent time there.
Yeah, so great question, James. So I arrived in Belfast about a week after OMA, which was the last big bombing of the war. and really caused a lot of change. And when I lived there, it was very divided. It still is in many ways. I don't think quite as much. Very policed. The military was still on the street. The RUC was a very aggressive police force for reasons I understand. And it was a very gritty city, in many ways similar to Detroit, but with a very different crime environment.
It's interesting now, and this is an apolitical statement. This is just a human statement. You know, I grew up on the mainland, and you know, we were having to check our cars for bombs because I lived on a farm right next to a Ministry of Defense base. And you know, there was bombings on the mainland. You know, women and children. But when you reverse, you know, engineer the origin of that hatred in the first place, you know, there's the potato famine, and you can go back and back and back. Now you've got a lot of the Irish people standing up for what's going on in Gaza. And, you know, the terrorism was supported even by Hollywood, you know, in the IRA back in the day. And now the very people that were, you know, trying to retake their homeland, now this voice is being mirrored in 2025. So it's interesting watching, you know, the generation I saw struggle when I was younger on both sides. And now you have this, you know, this united voice from those people speaking up for the oppressed. And I'm talking about the innocents, the women and children that are still being oppressed from both sides in that particular region.
Yeah, I think it's a characteristic of Irish people to support the underdog. Like that's mm-hmm. sort of part of their nature. But it's really not that new to me, James, because when I lived in West Belfast, there's murals over row houses everywhere that would support, you know, anti-apartheid, the Palestinian liberation movements, and different organizations that sought, you know, their own independence and sovereignty. So it doesn't surprise me that Irish people, you know, support the oppressed. Their history is really been colored by oppression.
Exactly. I think that's the point, is again, a political statement. If we stop this generational trauma, which is like we were talking about when you pull industry from parts of America, you create this generational trauma. If you can stop those dominoes from falling, that's how you, you know, finally halt this cycle of hurt. And obviously hurt people hurt people. So you know, we understand how we got here. The question is, how do we now draw a line in the sand and say enough is enough? All right, moving on. Let's go back to Brian then. So Brian, as you're progressing now, you're in the logistics side of AT&T. Talk to me about the birth of Lucas, and then let's talk about who he was as a little boy.
So when he was born, this is kind of an amusing story. My wife, he was born from an emergency C-section. She was far enough along. The doctor had us come to the hospital. Her labor wasn't progressing as fast as the doctor would have liked. So they did a few things, and then all of a sudden, now it was coming fast. And they had monitors on her. They had monitors on Lucas, and his heart rate started to drop. So split second decision, her doctor decided that baby was coming out. That baby was coming out right now. So they had me get dressed, put on a gown. By the time I put that on and they walked me into the operating room, she was already cut open and he was coming out. It happened that fast. So he comes out and, the story they told me is a newborn loses their body temperature faster if they're born cesarean than if it's a natural birth. So they put them under this thing. I call it a French fry lamp. It reminds me of looking over the counter at McDonald's because I'm actually standing. I left to go with him. Once that baby is born, they focus on mom. A whole nother team takes care of the baby. I go with him. And I'm standing there with him sweating at this point because I'm next to this heat lamp that they have him under. They're trying to warm him up. And the nurse says, she tells me, he has to cry. You got to make him cry more because it helps develop his lungs. I didn't know what to do. This is my first child. I'm brand new dad. I didn't know what to do. So she tells me, pull his hair. So I'm like pulling his hair. And then she takes my fingers and she's like, no, you have to make him cry. So like the kid's not on the planet for 5 minutes. And here's his dad pulling his hair under this lamp, making him cry. So that's how he came about to be on this earth. And then normal childhood, did everything that, you see on TV that a normal American boy would do, sports and bicycles and skateboards and girls and, you know, went to school right here in Woodhaven, went to high school, graduated high school. He had a normal childhood. Like I said, we've been blessed that both of us have always had good, stable jobs and have had a stable home. We got a very close-knit immediate family. He's got a younger brother, Evan, which he's 4 years younger. And then that's the only sibling. And all of my nieces and nephews, which are Luke and Evan's cousins, they're all very close, very tight-knit.
What sports was he playing through the school ages?
He played, we always were of the mindset to let them try anything, everything, whatever they liked. We never tried to force him into one thing or another. So he started out with trying to learn to ice skate and play hockey, which he didn't take to. He was in martial arts for a little bit. That really didn't stick. And then even if there were things that he didn't like, we were never the type of parents that made them continue to do something. And because I coached for a long time and I've seen in my opinion, the harm it does to a child when parents are forcing them to do something that they don't want to do. And, you know, the child's just miserable. So he played T-ball. He wrestled, and he didn't really take to that either. So he ended up not wrestling, played football for years. When he got into high school, he took up golf, was pretty good at it, but got the interest so much. He kept the high school didn't have a golf team, and he pestered that poor athletic director so much that athletic director finally gave in and started a golf team. And that he really did like that. Even after high school, when he was in college and even down in Atlanta, he tried to golf as much as he could. He enjoyed it.
What about career aspirations as he's progressing through those school ages? What was he talking to you about wanting to become?
He never, law enforcement didn't come up. He had a slight interest in veterinary medicine. He had talked about that. Nothing specific yet. I think he was trying to be open-minded. We noticed the interest in law enforcement when he was at Eastern Michigan, when he had graduated high school and he had enrolled in Eastern. I don't know if there was a course or something that he took, but that's when his family noticed it. He became interested there.
A lot of us in uniform, and I've seen this from over 1,000 interviews now. It's amazing how many people do have struggles from early life. And that is part of the overall equation, especially, God forbid, they end up taking their own life. When you reflect back now, obviously you said there was a healthy, healing home. Were there any other elements of his upbringing, bullying, anything like that, that you remember that might have contributed to his struggles later?
No. He was always a very outgoing kid. Was never like socially awkward or anything. He always was, you know, part of the group. He, you know, didn't have any social problems or anything like that. At least anything that we were aware of, or any of the schools were aware of. The school districts here are are pretty on top of that type of thing. So any child that's getting bullied at school, the parents are going to know about it. And that was never the case with him.
And what about in the football or martial arts? Did he ever take any large hits when he was younger?
No, nothing abnormal. I mean, football is a contact sport. Hockey is a contact sport. So nothing out of the ordinary, no.
So talk to me about the decision to enter law enforcement and then, you know, what that kind of on-ramp was like for him.
So he, like I said, when he was at Eastern, I can't put my finger on one thing that triggered it, that really set him off. I can tell you that when his uncle was with HSI, Homeland Security Investigations, and helped secure him the internship with the downtown Detroit office. And I think that if he was leaning that way, once he started that internship, it was all over. You can feel your child's excitement and like wake up wanting to go to work, wake up wanting, you know, telling stories like what they were supposed to do today, what they were going to do tomorrow. You could just feel it. You could hear it in his voice that he enjoyed it. And we knew at some agency, some department, somewhere that's where he was going to be. He wanted to stay with federal law enforcement at the time. I mean, the administration changed, rules changed, but at the time, the only federal agency that would hire him with no law enforcement experience, even though he had his degree, he was a graduate of Eastern Michigan at that time, was the Border Patrol. And that, I don't think he was ready for that path yet. So he started looking locally for police departments. There's a lot of law enforcement in my family, one of which was a chief at the time, would have hired him. All he had to do was say the word and would have gave him a job. But like Jared said, I think Lucas wanted the adventure and the excitement and those type of things that you don't get a lot of that with a small local police department. And Lucas wanted to do the adventurous things, the exciting things. So that led him to start looking at larger metropolitan police departments. I believe he just filled out a questionnaire. The Atlanta Police Department is constantly doing like hiring and job fairs and stuff like that. So he probably saw something online and applied. And then a couple of weeks after that, he got a notification to come down for testing and physicals and stuff like that. He passed all of that. And then maybe a week or two after that, they offered him a position and he took it. That's where he ended up.
So when he was assigned, kind of what was the kind of area that he was working in? And then also what were the shifts that he was working at that point?
So he, I believe it's during their field training, they get to preference. Jared, you can help me with this. I don't know what the laws are in other states, but in the state of Georgia, he had to be sworn in before the state of Georgia would let him go on the street with a gun or a taser or any of that. So he had finished the academic academy, so to speak, was sworn in as a police officer, and then was on the road with a training officer for months. And I think it was during that time they were allowed to preference where they wanted to go. Now in Atlanta, they don't call them precincts. They call them zones. I believe there are six. And he was smart enough to research that zone four was the, I don't know how to say this without just saying it, it's not the nicest area. Very busy, a lot of calls, a lot of crime, a lot of you name it. But he also was smart enough to find out that a lot of the command structure was promoted out of that zone because they see everything. For example, like some of the other zones are like more downtown. It's a lot of traffic, and he didn't want to do that. He wanted to be, like Jared says, chasing the bad guys. So that's where he went. Yeah, he got what he wanted. So, and then he worked the evening watch, which was about, he's starting about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's like 3 to 2 a.m. thereabouts.
Okay.
By the time he's at the zone, getting his car, getting his loaded up, getting his bag and all of that, it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. Well, Jared, do you want to jump in and kind of talk about where you and Lucas met?
Sure. Yeah. So Luke did an internship with my office, the HSI field office in Detroit, in the summer of 2021. And he was assigned to our global trade investigations group. They handle investigations of sensitive technology and military hardware and weapons, preventing those from leaving the country to get in the hands of our adversaries, countries like China and Russia and Iran and North Korea. And he was very eager, very enthusiastic about the job. You could tell that he was kind of mesmerized with the opportunity and had a goal in his life of becoming an agent. And I am confident that if things worked out differently, we would have hired him probably by now, if not sooner. And at the time, he actually potentially could have been hired by us. We weren't hiring at the time. There wasn't an announcement. But I think had there been an announcement, he would have been very competitive with his degree. And you know, when you do an internship, we like the young people. It's a learning opportunity where they get exposed to the job. And you know, if things turned out differently, probably would have been hired on already.
Well, Brian, back to you. As he's progressing through this young career, were there any changes in behavior? I don't want to say warning signs, because that almost sounds like, oh, we should have known, but changes in behavior when you reflect back now?
No, not changes that I would say were leading to his death. I just noticed a young man starting his life and starting his career and struggling probably like all of us did. Like, you know, the Atlanta Police Department has a wonderful benefit for their recruits. They actually built, the Atlanta Police Foundation built it's 4-story apartment building. So as they're going through the academy doing their field training, they have a very low rent apartment offered to them, fully furnished, pretty much just bring your clothes and go get yourself some groceries. He had the foresight to know that once he was done with his field training and got posted, he's going to have to get an apartment. So Atlanta's just like any other metro city, big metro city, expensive as heck to live downtown, but you're closer. Or you live 45 minutes outside of town, your rent is cheaper, but you got to deal with the commute and Atlanta traffic is horrible. So his apartment was in Atlanta proper, but, you know, outside a little bit, nice one bedroom with an office apartment. But he was, you know, he was dealing with all of that. Like, he had to figure out, okay, I got to figure out a budget. I got to get myself groceries. I got to pay my rent. Like, he lived at home. I work for AT&T. So his cell phone, his internet, his entertainment, you know, his satellite TV, I took care of all that because I get a discount on it. So he had to grow up like really fast because now he's got all of that stuff on his plate. And I could tell, and this is probably true for a lot of young, not just law enforcement officers, young people entering the workplace. I could tell, you know, the first thing that you scratch out of your budget is the fun stuff or the stuff that you're trying to eat. So he would make comments like, this certain McDonald's give you 99-cent cheeseburgers on Tuesdays. So things like that, you know, like, okay, the kid doesn't have a lot of money for groceries, so he's going to McDonald's to get 99-cent cheeseburgers. You know, I can read between the lines, but nothing, nothing upsetting to the point that we ever thought that there was something wrong. And that is one of the things that haunts me, is like, what did I not see?
It's been really interesting learning from all these people, yourself, and then, the lived experience stories, the people that survived suicide attempts, the psychologists, psychiatrists, I mean, all these layers. And when I think back to how suicide was presented to us collectively when we were younger, it was, well, it's cowardly, it's selfish. How could you think of your family? And then you actually listen to people that have been there, which arguably is probably what we should have done all along. And you realize that through the perfect storm of all the contributing elements, and I'll list them, doesn't mean it's pertinent to Lucas specifically, but so many of them: unaddressed childhood trauma, sleep deprivation is a huge one, organizational stress and betrayal, the side effects of psych meds, alcohol. I mean, and then you've got this massive, like I said, perfect storm of lots of factors rather than one. Oh, it was because you had that one call. Yeah, well, we have lots and lots of calls. That's not the only thing. But when you hear the voice of these men and women, their reality is literally distorted. And that voice in their head is telling them, this is more so, I think, more pertinent when it's someone who's actually, got young children and that kind of thing. You are a burden to your family. You are the reason that your family is feeling pain. And if you just remove yourself because you swore to die for strangers, well, surely you can die for your loved ones, and you've got the means of it right on your hip. Now you've got this horrendous, arguably psychosis, because all these factors have literally rewired the brain. And if that person truly believes that, and or there's this element of, I just want this pain to stop as well, it's combined. Now, arguably, it's courageous and selfless, because they once again sacrifice their life for someone that they, in this case, love. So what is so sad is now, understanding this 8.5 years later, this needs to be front and center. If you are feeling like a burden, if you hear people say, I'm a piece of shit, or, my kids are scared of me, whatever the thing is, that is something that we really need to be talking about. Because if you can pull them back into a healthier mind again, none of these people would actually go through with taking their own life. So with that all being said, were there any elements of that when you reflect back now, a kind of guilt, shame element?
No, I do. I do remember he had to adjust to the sleep patterns. When he was done with his field training and he got posted in zone 4, he was never used to working afternoon or night type shift, and he was tired a lot. So I work crazy shifts like that, and I told him, I said, Luke, you gotta at least what works for me is I have to treat that shift like it's a day shift. Wake up an hour before you got to go to work, just like you would in the morning. Go to work, come home, stay awake for a few hours, just like you would in the evening, and then eat something and go to bed. And once you get into that routine and you keep doing it, your body will adjust. And he was coming out of that. He was, because ironically, our shifts overlapped. Like, I would be coming home from work when he was going in, and vice versa. So I pretty much talked to him at the beginning of his shift and at the end of his shift almost every day. And I could tell by his voice that, he was sleeping better and he sounded better. So I don't think that was a factor at the end there. I really, like I said, there was no note. There was, the detectives went through everything, you know what the procedure is. They went through everything, his phone, his tablets, email, everything. And there was nothing.
Well, let's talk about that day then. So January 9th, 2024, the events leading up to, and then, let's unpack how you and your family even process the grief of losing your beloved son.
So I was just, it started like a normal day. I remember University of Michigan's football team played in the national championship game the night before. and him and one of his best friends walked over to a little hamburger beer place, like within walking distance of their apartment. They watched like half the game and came back to their apartment, watched the rest of the game. And that was like the last we had heard of them. I have to get up to go to work at like 3:30 in the morning. So I was long asleep and got up, went to work, and it was actually 5:06 a.m. I got a routine. Like I walk in the building, I put my stuff down on this table and my phone, keys, that type of thing. And I go out in the back of our building and start getting my day going. And my one coworker, we're usually the first two in the building, she comes running with my phone. She said, "Evan's called you like four times. He's blowing your phone up." Now that's not, at the time was not odd, because he played college football. Their practices started at 6 a.m. So he was awake, and I just assumed something was wrong with his car, something silly like that. So when I called him back and he finally answered the phone, he says, "Dad, you got to sit down." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Dad, you have to sit down." And I said, "Evan, just fucking tell me." And he said, "Luke's dead." And I say this because I've never asked Evan, but like your brain kind of does what it wants to do. And what I heard come out of his mouth was that he actually accidentally shot himself. So I tried, and I didn't even realize that there was questions as why Evan was calling me and not my wife. Well, we found out that they had tried to call her. I don't believe they tried to call me. I don't believe the police department tried to call me. And they must have had Evan as a contact, so they called him. So somewhere around 4:15 a.m. he went into his shower and started the shower, got in the shower and put a handgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger, shot himself. So now I call my wife. I looked at my coworker. I said, "I got to go." She could tell something bad had happened. So I called Marie, and she was like incoherent. I couldn't even understand what she was saying. I just told her, "I'm on my way home right now." So I left, got in my truck. It's about a half hour, 35 minutes away. I called Evan back and told him, because he was still at school, I said, "Drop everything you're doing and get your butt home." Because, obviously we needed people at the house. I still didn't know what all was going to happen or any of that. So when I got home, I go through the garage into the house through the entry door, and I'm sure of it that Marie was still standing in the spot she was standing when I talked to her a half hour before. And I'm sorry.
Take your time, brother. There's no rush at all.
The sound of his mom. I can't get that out of my head. Just the pain coming out of her. I still couldn't understand what she was saying. But on the way home, I had looked for flights. There was no flights until the afternoon. So I looked at her. I said, I'm not waiting. I'm going to Atlanta right now. I'm leaving right now." Her mother lives with us, which I don't really think was the case, but Marie was not going to be in any kind of condition to go down there and see him or see that. And she told me, "I can't go. I can't go see him like that." And I said, okay, I'm going. I said, I'm not waiting for nobody. I grabbed what I had laying around and jumped in my truck. And by probably quarter after six, I was on my way to Atlanta to go get them. Or so James, at that point, I still had not had any kind of confirmation from anybody. This is the only person I heard that from at that point was Evan. So I was kind of in the dark still. So as I'm driving to Atlanta, I was probably in the Toledo area. And this is actually a point that I bring up to the recruits at the academy class when I go speak to them is, like, I knew his friends. I knew their names because he talked about them all the time. I didn't have any of their phone numbers. So I didn't know who to call. His one roommate, I did have his number, but he was no longer with APD. So I had no idea of who to try to get a hold of. And it just struck me to call the desk sergeant. I called the desk sergeant at Zone 4 of Atlanta Police Department. And she answered the phone. I never did get that young lady's name. I'm sure whatever the technology is, my caller ID came up. And she said, Sizemore, Sizemore, we're getting these reports. These reports are coming in. Are you okay? And I said, ma'am, I said, this is Brian Sizemore. I'm Lucas's dad. I said, I'm getting the same reports. I'm in my truck on my way to Atlanta right now. And she said, okay, Mr. Sizemore, Major Clay is on his way to the scene and he'll call you as soon as he's got some information. And I would say about a half hour after that, it wasn't Major Clay that called me. It was Chief Shearbaum of the Atlanta Police Department called me, and he was the one that confirmed that Lucas was dead. He had just left the scene. He was on his way to Zone 4. He wanted to be there for their roll call that morning because word was starting to get out. I'm sure it was over the radio and that type of stuff, so he wanted to be there to let them all know. And then throughout the day, the chief himself probably called me at least 12 times to make sure I was okay, asked me where I was. I got phone calls from the chaplains. Major Clay called out, and that's on top of having to, now I gotta start calling my family. And like Marie knew, Evan knew, but I had to call my mom and dad. I had to call my sister. I had to call his cousins, the aunts and uncles. I had to call all these family members and tell them. I had to call Paul and tell him. And it just sucked. That was hard. The whole day was unbelievably hard. Still is.
So talk to me about the next few weeks. I mean, you know, you have this jarring loss from the family point of view first, as far as simply dealing with grief. You know, what, when you reflect back now, were the things that you guys did well and what were the things that you would do differently possibly?
That's a hard one to answer. I was in Atlanta for, I want to say it was 4, maybe 5 days. And I'm grateful that his classmates and his friends were able to help me. This was all new to me. Like I said, my sister and brothers are still alive. My mom and dad are still alive. I've never had to make funeral arrangements for anybody. So, and being that he was out of state, it was almost like having to make two sets of arrangements because he of course went to the medical examiner's office. I had to make arrangements for him to be picked up from there and taken to a funeral home in Atlanta so they could prep him to bring him on a flight to Detroit. When I finally did get to Atlanta, the chief and the police foundation had me put up in a hotel, and they took so good care of me. They just alleviated all that extra hassle from me. They asked the questions that I knew that they were going to ask, and reassured me that I would get his badge and his belongings and stuff after they were done with what they had to do. And then I had to go through the process of, the next morning I had to go clean out his apartment. I had to package up his clothes and I don't know if it would have been better or worse if I had a family member with me when I walked into that apartment, because I walked in there, I could still smell him. I could smell his cologne. I could smell his deodorant. I could smell what he cooked the night before. And that I kind of lost it a little bit when I walked in there. And then I immediately go into get things done mode and started packaging up his clothes and everything, and filled up my truck and filled up his car. And the next day we got him from the medical examiner and took his remains out to the funeral home where they prepped him. Sometimes it may have helped me to have a family member with me when I was down there. But then on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I was able to get it done, and for lack of better words, there wasn't anyone in my way or telling me do this or do that. I was pretty much all business. So down there, I don't think I had a whole lot of time to grieve, because I was so almost overwhelmed with everything that I had to do just to get him home. Now, luckily, I came home and his flight was going to be a couple days later. So then when I got home, I had to drive back home. I pulled up. You couldn't park on my street. There were so many people here, friends, family. On one hand, that helped. But then on the other hand, I was tired and I just wanted to sleep. Marie was just – it's painful to me to see her pain. And Evan has really struggled too. His only brother is gone. And again, I haven't had to deal with this kind of grief. So I don't know if we're doing it right or not. I can only tell you how we're doing it. Every day something will trigger me to get emotional. And sometimes it's silly things a certain song I'll hear, or the smell of some kind of food that he liked, or, something silly like that. But I don't think I'll ever get over it.
I want to bring Jared in, but just one more question. You seem to have two kind of paths when this is the reason that we lose someone. Either A, you get these families that, they put it out there, this is what happened. And I think that is the conversation that we need to have. And then there's still this other path where people kind of want to keep it hush hush. And that's where the stigma comes in. And we just lost another FDNY firefighter a couple of days ago. And I happened to find out through a page that had all these, helpline numbers attached to it and everything. You're like, oh, okay, so it was a suicide. But all the official notifications was nothing mentioned. Every time we just see, someone died suddenly, air right. quotes, then we can read between the lines, but it's never actually put out there. So did you encounter any kind of stigma in the arena that you were in, or was it actually received the way it should have been?
So when I, the, within, I would say within a half hour after I drove right from Detroit to Atlanta. Only thing I stopped for was gas. I got to Marietta, which is just north of Atlanta. Chief told me to pull into the McDonald's. He called me, told me to pull into the McDonald's. When I got there, there were two police cars. One was his training officer, and another patrolman, and then his best friend. So his best friend, they didn't want me to drive no more. His best friend drove my truck, who was another APD officer, and then the training officer and the other patrolman, they took the police cars, bracketed us, took us right downtown to the hotel. So we go upstairs into this conference room. The detectives and everyone asked the questions that they needed to ask. One of the chaplains was going to assist me with making some arrangements and all of those type of things. And so literally half hour, 45 minutes sitting in this conference room, chief is sitting right next to me. And he was close with Lucas, because Lucas, as they progress through the academy, they have a job. They're given a job. Some work in the motor pool, doing odd jobs. Some will work, in evidence, doing odd jobs. Lucas got posted in the chief's office. So he did administrative and clerical stuff right there in the chief's office every day. So Chief Shearbaum walked past him and talked to him every day. So it hit home to him as well. So he was emotional. And I asked him, I said, can we step out in the hallway for a second? And I took him out in the hallway and told him right then. That's so maybe 13 hours after I was notified that he had passed away, I told Chief Shearbaum that the family wants to start this foundation. I don't want this to happen anymore. I don't want families to have to go through this. I don't want whatever pain that these heroes have to lead them down the path to that final solution. It doesn't have to end up like that. I have a sister-in-law who's an attorney. An hour after that, I was in my hotel room, called her and said, hey, get the paperwork ready. I don't know what I want to call it yet. I don't know any of the details, but have the paperwork ready. So when I'm home in 4 days, I can sign that stuff and we can send it to the state of Michigan. And that's how it happened. There was never, for me anyway, there was never, this might sound off color too, is I have the type of personality that I don't give a shit what people think. And especially, Marie says that I used to have a very small filter. And now she said, I just set it down somewhere and walked away from it because I have no filter. I say it, sometimes it sounds brutal, but I try to be honest. I like, the grief is so overwhelming. I'm like, I don't care what people think. I don't care what they think of him. I do, but it, he's gone and he shouldn't be. So let's get past that and try to figure out why and figure out what these people need so this stops.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the thing that really makes me sad is the ones that actually are acknowledged are such a small part of just the ones that are in uniform. And then there's another entire forgotten group, which is the retirees. There is no VA for police and fire. So yep, none of those.
They are not talked about. Yep. Absolutely. You're exactly right. They do not get talked about at all.
Well, Jared, let's bring you in. Firstly, from your profession, your unique perspective within the profession itself. What have you seen within your agency or the law enforcement community as a whole as far as the prevalence of this issue?
It's a great question. So, for Brian and for Marie and for Evan and for the Atlanta Police Department, Lucas's suicide is, for the family, it's the most tragic event of their life. And it's traumatic for many, many people. But Brian is not alone. And there are thousands of families just like them suicide is the leading cause of death in law enforcement. There are more law enforcement officers that die as a result of suicide than felonious assaults, than vehicular accidents, than training accidents. And it's by a lot. And if you take away accidents, suicides outpace felonious assaults that result in death for law enforcement agents, officers, by like 7-3. And I don't want to take anything away from your profession, James. I know that it's a big issue in the fire service, and it's a big issue in emergency medicine and with all first responders. Our heart is with law enforcement first, because it's what Lucas did. It's what I do. It's what a lot of my friends and coworkers do. But it's a massive issue. I think that we're on the front end of some change. There's been a terrible stigma to discussing mental health within law enforcement since the beginning. It was viewed as weakness to talk about any challenges that you have. And yet law enforcement officers have two big categories of trauma that they deal with routinely. So you've got the chronic and you've got the acute, right? So the acute is what you would think of, you know, the critical incidents, the emergency situations that you have to respond to, the spikes in heart rate and chemical reactions in your body that have a fatiguing effect on your body, but also the chronic. You brought up something, and I know exactly what you were going at when you asked what shift Evan works. And you know how difficult night shifts and shifts that change, where, you know, 1 week or 1 month you're doing nights, and the next one you're doing evenings, and the next you're doing daytime. Mm-hmm. And that change is not good for the body. And the demands of police work are underappreciated by the public. And it's the same with the fire service as well. I think, generally speaking, the difference between police and firefighters is that everyone likes firefighters. But a lot of people don't like police. And I think we're emerging from an era where the real hatred for law enforcement is starting to fade. And this is, we're coming out of a period where it was much like soldiers returning from the Vietnam War in the United States, who were hated by the public for a job that they maybe didn't even volunteer to do. In the case of law enforcement, you do volunteer, but it's a noble profession that is terribly underappreciated by the public. And I think that law enforcement officers as public servants, I think that the public has some skin in the game with the law enforcement mental health challenges.
Absolutely. No, it's interesting because we have this conversation, obviously, professionally between police and fire. And it's true, like the surface level admiration is definitely different. And I've experienced this. I've written about it in my books, driving down OBT in Orlando, red light district, you know, gangbangers and sex workers and all the people. And they're waving at us because we're the firefighter paramedics that are going to be there on their worst day. Whereas for law enforcement, they're, you know, maybe there's one finger raised, but not the whole hand, you know, to them, because, you know, they're a threat to them in that particular world that they inhabit. But actually, when you look at the true support, where the rubber meets the road for the fire, it's what they would use today, virtue signaling. People think they admire firefighters, but when it comes to actually saying, well, hey, we need more firefighters because they're being worked into the ground, then it's crickets. So you've got this. It's different, but it's almost, it's not, I'm not going to say worse, because each of us have our challenges, but imagine everyone thinking that you're really well taken care of, but behind the scenes, you're having just, you know, you're being shredded. And I'll give you a perfect example, and I'm happy to put this on air. We have a state representative, Danny Alvarez, who just put in a bill that this works for police and fire, and it's a health initiative. And one of the things on the bill was to go to a 42-hour work week for firefighters. Because unbeknownst to most people, because we do a terrible job telling the public what we actually do, a lot of our men and women, in that 24-hour period, they're up pretty much all night running calls. And they work 56 hours a week. And then there's mandatory overtime. And one overtime for us is another 24-hour period. So now it's an 80-hour work week. So Danny's put this in. This is a fight that I've been doing for a long time. The Florida Fire Chiefs Association puts out an email amongst themselves that they agree with this bill, apart from the 42-hour work week. So these chiefs that work 40 hours a week and go home at 5 p.m. every night, Monday to Friday, behind closed doors are saying, we don't think our firefighters should work less than 56. So these are the kind of, you know, behind the scenes things that are happening. When I said organizational betrayal, that is an immense, you know, detriment to a human psyche when the very tribe they've sworn to die for cuts their legs from them. So all these different areas that you have, I mean, you guys, especially from the public, from the politicians, it's disgusting. I mean, you look at some of these horrendous mistakes that were made by individuals in a law enforcement uniform. A lot of times they were held accountable to the full letter of the law, but that's not how it was portrayed on the media. So, you know, all the first responder professions, you have this outward facing kind of perspective, but actually in a lot of them, when you look behind the scenes, it's a lot worse than people even realize.
Yeah, I believe it. To your point, James, that's got to be very disheartening, especially since those chiefs that are having those discussions behind closed doors have done your job, have been the ones working 80 hours, and they should know better.
Well, a lot of them haven't. A lot of them, I mean,
and I'm maybe that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, more often than not, you'll see that there is a kind of person that will get off the streets as quickly as they can, stay on the administrative route, and then climb that ladder. So they haven't experienced that, which is even worse.
Right. For sure.
Well, Jared, going back to you, talk to me then about, you know, when you learned of Lucas's death, and then let's kind of collectively walk forward from the foundation and then what we're doing next.
So a couple years had passed, and I hadn't had any additional contact with Luke between the time he completed his internship with us in August of 21 until a Sunday morning. I got a call from a work colleague, a retired work colleague, who is friends with Luke's uncle, who also is a retired agent. And he said that there was an Atlanta police officer who had died and originally from Detroit, and asked if we could facilitate the transfer of his body when it arrived at the Detroit airport. And I still didn't know who we were talking about. And then it occurred to me, this was Lucas Sizemore, our former intern. And so at that point, we did everything we could to roll out the red carpet. So his flight arrived from Atlanta late at night. It was, I think, after midnight or sometime late on this Sunday evening, Monday morning. And we worked with a bunch of law enforcement agencies and organized an honor escort from Plainside all the way to the funeral home with, you know, several law enforcement vehicles with lights on, taking them all the way home. And I think this is a really touching story for law enforcement. None of the people that showed up at the airport to escort Lucas's body home knew him. But there is a real brotherhood and sisterhood in law enforcement, and I assume in the fire service, where we, you know, we really care about one another. And so I think that was just a special moment, seeing that happen and having people that had no contact with him make sure that he got the dignity that he deserved. And a couple days after that was the funeral. It was a snowy gray day in Detroit, and Brian won't remember it, but I had met Brian and Marie for the first time, and hundreds of other people. Enormous service at a Catholic church in the Downriver community. Very nice service. The first several rows at Mass were filled with the officers from Luke's Academy class. Tremendous turnout from Atlanta Police Department. Tremendous turnout local law enforcement here in Detroit and Southeast Michigan. And I didn't reengage Brian until this past September, where we were both at an event. A friend of ours puts on a 10-kilometer swim in the Detroit River to raise awareness about military mental health and suicide. And so by circumstance, I just ran into Brian and Marie there. And this idea for a major event to sponsor the 1,000-mile law enforcement relay run to prevent law enforcement suicide kind of developed just naturally from that day. And over the past, what have we been working on this, Brian? 7 months, 8 months, I think?
Yep.
Just there's so many little magical events that have happened where by circumstance we'll just happen to meet the right person to help us with sponsorships, or just all these magical things that fall in place where we're interacting with good people that want to help out with this effort. And it's given Brian and I both a real sense of purpose of something important to work on. So September 23rd in Atlanta, our 1,000-mile law enforcement relay run is going to begin, and it's going to run 24 hours a day for the next 7 days. It's going through Georgia and Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, into Michigan, and it's going to finish here in Detroit. It's about 135 legs. The majority of those legs are at where the runners transition from one group to the next, where they pass the baton. Majority of those locations are at police stations, sheriff's offices, state police, federal law enforcement offices. We're doing that on purpose to stimulate this conversation in all those locations. One of the things Brian's really passionate about is large departments have lots of resources, right? So if you work for Atlanta Police Department or NYPD or LAPD, you're joining a giant agency that has mental health resources and has lots of support systems. But a lot of these locations where we're going through in rural Southeast and the rural Midwest, some of these departments have, you know, a dozen officers, and they don't have the infrastructure that the bigger organizations and the federal agencies have. So the money that we're going to raise is going to benefit that effort to provide resources where the resources for mental health don't exist. It's a major event. So there's a lot of conversations that are being started right now about mental health in the law enforcement community. And we're trying to take out the stigma. We're trying to create a movement here by doing something that's going to draw a lot of attention. We hope to draw a lot of media attention during this last week in September. We're hoping to get a bill, a resolution passed in Congress in support of law enforcement mental health and help us prevent suicide. And it's a tremendous effort.
Well, Brian, let's roll back for a second. So you have this idea shortly after you lose your son. You talk to your sister about preparing legal documents. Talk to me about the unfolding of the foundation in the first place.
This is new to us. So I think I was just overwhelmed with the yearning to help these heroes. I like Jared said, it's not talked about. When it happens, it's not published. It's not, like you said, James, like you just hear or you see that somebody passed away, but it's not posted how or why, or so you kind of got to read between the lines. In my experience, when I was in Atlanta to get him, I found out that it had just happened successfully. And then there was an attempt that, you know, obviously it was unsuccessful. So in since then, I'm hypersensitive to it. Like I listen for it in the news, and it is nonstop. It's probably once a week here in our own backyard. You hear about it in Texas. You hear about it in the East Coast. It happens constantly, and it'll get reported, but that's where it stops. You don't hear anything about any kind of follow-up care or what's next for that department. What are they doing for the officers that are left? I mean, it just stops. these officers died by suicide. Here's their funeral arrangements. And then that's it. You don't hear anything about it. So it was our initial focus and has always been our focus to try to do whatever we can to help them. And when I speak to them, I tell them I'll go anywhere and do anything to help those guys. So we've had several local little fundraisers and they're always successful. And we get, you know, large crowds from the surrounding Detroit community. And we always have a good time and a lot of support from the law enforcement community. So when I reconnected with Jared at that fundraiser we were at a couple weeks after that, he called me with this idea to do this national event. And it seemed so daunting and so large of an undertaking. I didn't think we could pull it off. But then every week, it was like bowling pins. Every week we knocked that one down, we knocked that one down, we knocked that one down. And then I say probably a couple months ago, we kind of looked at each other and we're so far along. We're like, this is going to happen. So now it's like he said, you get excited by like these little things that happen. Like maybe today we do this, maybe nothing happens tomorrow. Monday, some other little good thing will happen. And then something else will happen on Wednesday. And it's just one thing after another that we can see it now. We can see it. And like he said, my ultimate goal, if someone handed me $1 billion to spend on these heroes, what I would like to see a mental health program created by law enforcement to treat law enforcement. I want their specific program designed, created by them, for them. And then some type of training regimen instituted so the mental health professionals can get on board with what law enforcement personnel want and what law enforcement personnel need. And if you are in law enforcement, you're a police officer, you're an agent, you're in corrections, you need some kind of mental health assistance, you go to an office or you are looking for a mental health professional online and you see that logo, that Lucas logo, you know that they've been through that training and that they're there for them.
Again, this journey that I've been on, learning from all these people, one of the biggest aha moments I had was to get into the fire service. I worked for four agencies professionally. Three of them, I had to lie my way through a polygraph because I tried being honest at the beginning of my career. And when you tell them what you did, they were like, oh, you can't be a firefighter. I was like, oh, so you have to lie. Got it. Because most people that put the uniform on, we've done some stuff when we were younger. That's why we're good at what we, you know, right, going into danger. But that being said, there's a thing called the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Interview. And everyone in the mental health community, the professionals that I've asked about this, they were like, well, that was never supposed to be a standalone psychological test to deem someone to be the right kind of person to be in uniform, police, fire, EMS. So at the front door, there's a lot of box checking. The polygraph is just a magic show. And the MMPI is, you know, arguably supposed to be used as a gamut of tests for forensic psychology. So neither of them really have any value. If we shift the lens and understand that because these people are coming into uniform, a lot of people do have things when they were younger that were arguably traumatic. Now, when they are processed, that becomes a strength, hands down. You become a more compassionate, more resilient first responder. But if they're buried down and pushed, that can be a fracture in your foundation. So understanding that, you know, having the same as PT in the academy, having counseling as part of your on-ramp that continues mm-hmm. through your career, I think is imperative. And then again, like you said, aligning that with the right kind of mental health thing. The other thing that drives me crazy is locally here, the chief of the department that protects my family have had arguably seven suicide attempts of which five we've lost. And he did a speech recently after we had two within 12 weeks of each other, two young firefighters. And he said, we don't have the answers. Well, that's absolute bullshit. We do have the answers. We know all these different parts of these puzzle. Now, does that mean that you can save everyone? No, but it means that there are these elements that we can prevent. As you mentioned, just simply providing counseling is one of them. Mm-hmm. But then the other one is sleep. If we're going to ask someone to be awake while everyone else is safely in their beds, we need to give our first responders more rest and recovery between shifts so they can get back to baseline. So I think this is why, you know, this is what drives me. It's what drives you. It drives everyone else that's kind of on this mission, is we know that there are ways that we can help a lot of people, not everyone, but a huge portion of these people that are struggling, we can get to with these initiatives like the one that you're creating. But this, you know, shoulder shrugging, and I'll give you a perfect example. Every year, 40,000 Americans die on our roads. Arguably, a lot of them are children. When have you ever heard anyone say, we're going to change the age of a driving license? We're going to make it harder to get a driving license, so you have to have a higher level of driving. Nothing. People just, oh, well, just put a round circle by the freeway and we're good. So it's the people that are driven by this pain that need to be the voices, because the ones that we pay a lot of money that are in the government buildings don't seem to be doing a lot of anything. So right. I applaud you for turning this grief into this mission, because you will make a difference. Absolutely, hands down, you'll make a difference.
Thank you. We're trying.
You know, James, one of the reasons we're so grateful to get on your podcast and to talk to your audience is mainly about the issue, right? We want to remove the stigma of discussing struggles about mental health within the law enforcement community, but we also want to advertise this run. We want to get the word out about this, especially to your listeners that are going to be along our route along I-75. You know, we're going to be going through a lot of rural communities in Tennessee and Kentucky and northern Georgia, and we need more runners to join us. We need more corporate sponsors. We're really, really grateful. This last week, Home Depot, fantastic pro-American, pro-law enforcement company, signed on as our largest corporate sponsor. We're tremendously grateful to them. General Dynamics, Land Systems, another sponsor. And there are companies that I think realize that they have skin in the game. And we're particularly interested in getting sponsorships from corporations that have law enforcement contracts, that sell equipment or services or what have you to law enforcement, where they make a buck off the back of law enforcement. And we're hoping that some of those companies, those good companies, are interested in giving back and helping out the good guys.
I had a great connection with 5-11. There's been some shift in the management there, so I'm trying to reconnect, but I'm sure they would be a company that would want to help. I mean, I'm being presumptive, but I mean, they do a lot of kind of altruistic work as well.
Yeah, we'd love that. They're on our list. I haven't engaged 5-11 yet, but I will. And they're listening. What about, I'm calling you.
What about AT&T, Brian? Because I know that they, I think at least on the fire side, they're the main or the biggest company that we use for communication, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I not to put the cart before the horse, but there are negotiations taking place. It's a little too early for me to give any details, but I am very confident that they're going to come through.
That's great to hear. I think this is the thing that I do, even with the sponsors for the show. Every single one, I don't think people realize this. Every single one, bar one that was brought to me that was an amazing product. It's called Team Builder. It's a kind of online fitness scheduling program that they have a whole tactical arm. Incredible. But every other one, 5-11 included, I have used their stuff and said, this profession needs to know about this company. Thorn Supplements, you know, so many different companies. Because people are going to spend money. And I think the social businesses, the businesses that are actually doing good things as well, are the ones that need to be highlighted. So, you know, they are helping, you know, with this mission, but I think it's equally important for us to highlight those businesses that are worth the dollar, basically.
Yeah, that brand association, I think, is really powerful when a brand shows that it that it's a member of the community, right? The greater community, that it supports and understands some of the struggles that first responders have. I think that's a really positive brand association.
Absolutely. Well, Brian, so people listening now, you need runners, you need corporate sponsors. Where can people go to learn more about the event? And then how can they either sign up to run and or sign up to actually support financially?
The web address is www.lucascrusade.org. It's LucasCrusade, no spaces. On that site, you will see the menu for the relay segments. That will show you the route. And Jared, correct me if I'm wrong, probably next week when our IT lady is back, Tori's back, the registration for those. So you can go on the site now and look at the route and look at all the segments and in your mind potentially know which segment or segments that you're going to want to run. The registration portion of that is not live yet, and I believe that will be live next week. The sponsorship information is on there now, along with contact information. You can see the sponsorship levels, and our contact information is on there. There's email addresses on there if anyone has any questions regarding sponsorship. And James, it's not – we – obviously we want corporate sponsors. We want big corporate sponsors, but that doesn't preclude my neighbor, Bob next door. I cut his grass and stuff. I'm sure he'll go on there and donate $20. You know, a bunch of them is just as welcome as Home Depot. Not anything against Home Depot. We love them, but you know, what Jared is really good at talking about is it's as important to me to have a million people go on there and donate $1 just because now so many people are involved and so many people are now aware that what we're trying to do and trying to make a difference, you know, instead of having 5 big corporate sponsors, which we want. I still want the public and the nation to know about this because that's the only way anything is going to happen.
Absolutely. Well, I'll stay with you for a second, Brian. Is there anything else you want to add before we close out?
Yeah, personally to Jared, thank you. It's hard enough dealing with the grief, but to try to plan and do something as big as what we're doing, there's no way I would have been able to do this by myself. And to the officers that are in training, the ones that are the recruits, to the ones that are on the job now, and to the retirees, you go on to the foundation's main website, and the link is there from the Relay's website. If you don't have mental health resources, my personal phone number is on that site. If you need to talk to somebody, you can call me. Brilliant. Can call me. I'm not any kind of mental health professional, but I will talk to you. I promise you I will talk to you.
There's a great organization called the Overwatch Collective, Overwatch Collective. And they actually fund mental health resources for, like, just like you said, people that are looking. And mm-hmm. You know, sadly, even like the locality of some of these people don't have the ability to even find a counselor that is culturally competent in their area. So that's another great one in the interim. If you find yourself, you know, hitting a brick wall, the Overwatch Collective, and that's law enforcement based as well. So Jared, what about you? Anything to add before we round off?
No, James, I just wanted to thank you for your service. You're a public servant, and you also are a public servant for what you do through your podcast. The attention that you've given to this issue of first responder mental health is huge. Thank you for letting us talk about this to your audience. And God bless you.
Yes, ditto. Thanks a lot, James. We appreciate you.